You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jazz Brzezak, union organizer with Starbucks Workers United, one of the OGs in Buffalo. Then Michael Bronski, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Harvard University. On the return of the grooming meme and the Christian politics of innocence. Also on the program, blistering January 6th testimony yesterday shows the lengths that Trump and crew went in their attempt to overturn the election. Meanwhile, with hearings building momentum amongst the public, Democrats float the possible idea of extending them. Speaking of the big lie, Fox News Corp lost their motion to quash the massive voting machine defamation suit they are facing. Could cost them billions or worse. Move to discovery and have their hosts deposed. The gun reform bill, anemic as it is, clears the initial vote in the Senate. Supreme Court rules that states who subsidize private schools must fund religious ones too. This is worse than it sounds, and it sounds pretty bad. More details emerge of the Uvalde police failures as Texas stonewalls releasing information. Georgia and Alabama runoff primaries held last night. Mixed bag for the Trumpies. Sadly, in Texas 28, Cuellar and the leadership of the Democratic Party who supported this anti-abortion conservative Democrat officially called the winner in his race over Jessica Cisneros. Lastly, Louisiana's new law would send abortion providers to jail for up to 10 years, no exceptions for rape or incest. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma is gone for almost a week. So what can I tell you? But she'll be back. In the meantime, it'll be just me. Apologies in advance, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get to it. I was off yesterday. I watched a big chunk of the hearings. They are gaining steam. There are a surprising polling as to how many people have been watching the hearings. They've been getting ratings. Of course, the big ratings were on primetime, so the Democrats didn't want to get too carried away with this threat to democracy thing, so they decided to put it on during daytime. Nevertheless, 58% of voters heard about the hearings that were held on June 13th and 16th. 38% of voters said they watched or listened to at least some of them. Now, there was obviously a big substantial partisan divide. 56% of Democratic voters watched, 32% of independents, and 25% of Republicans. Just 38% said they heard a lot or some of retired Judge Michael Luttig's statement to the Jan 6 committee that Trump and his allies instigated a war on democracy. 62% of voters said they heard not much or nothing at all. Meanwhile, 42% of voters heard a lot or some about Elon Musk's statements that he recently voted for a Republican for the first time in his life. Nevertheless, despite the fact that more people heard about Elon Musk, because of course they did, because he's a billionaire and he gets a lot of coverage.
He's a billionaire attention seeker.
Yes. But the idea that you have 25% of Republicans, 30-some-odd percent, 8% of independents, I don't think it's going to make a difference in 2022 because of the, frankly, the strategy by the Democratic leadership to say that some good Republicans good, even though they're all on board with this stuff. Other Republicans bad. This never-Trumper strategy is a huge mistake, in my opinion, by the Democrats. Nevertheless, the hearings, I think, are going to hurt Trump. And probably not so much within the Republican Party. He's still going to have the plurality of support within the Republican Party. But Raffensperger tested yesterday. This is the Secretary of State from Georgia. The reason why Donald Trump lost in 2020 was because there was 35,000 or so Republicans who voted down ticket and left the top of the ticket blank. And I think these hearings may end up increasing that number in certain areas, depending on who the Democratic nominee is. We shall see. But it is interesting. And certainly, the testimony was pretty moving. Here is testimony from Shay Moss. She was a Georgia elections worker, harassed by Rudy Giuliani, accused of rigging the election results in Georgia. She's just a woman whose mom had been an election worker. She was a poll worker, and it had shattered her life. I also happen to think, and there is a suit that's out there, there is a strong case for defamation here. She is not a public person, at least wasn't at the time that she was attacked by Giuliani and Trump. Here is parts of her testimony.
Those horrible things, that they include threats?
Yes, a lot of threats, wishing death upon me, telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920. That's,
yeah. Were a lot of these threats and vile comments racist in nature?
A lot of them were racist. A lot of them were just hateful.
Is that all we have? Do we not have more? Okay. Nevertheless, she goes on to talk about how she has been unable to leave her house. She has unable to say her name publicly. When she goes to a restaurant or uses her credit card, her mother, same situation. She's gained 60 pounds since the election because of the enormous stress that she has been under. And in a very dramatic moment, she says, imagine that the president of the United States singles you out and makes you a villain. I mean, it really is a stunning thing to contemplate. The most powerful position in the world. And the guy plucks her out of obscurity so that he can create this narrative that the election was stolen in Georgia. Later in the program, we're going to play clips from the Arizona Speaker of the House, Rusty Bowers, an old white guy. I was disinclined to to assume that I would be in any way sympathetic with this guy. And I certainly have my issues, but I think a very effective witness. And the interesting dynamic that's taking place with these hearings now is that because there are no Republicans on the committee, short of Lynn Cheney, no Republicans aligned with the leadership of the Republican House at the moment, anyways, politically aligned, just not aligned in this instance. The Republicans have no idea what's coming. They can maybe see who's going to be called as witnesses, but they have no idea what all of the testimony has already been taken. You depose these people, you see what's in there, and then you approach they have no insight as to what is coming. They had no insight into Raffensperger testifying that there were 18 attempts to get him on the phone. 18. For this audio of Donald Trump. Play this audio. Now, everybody had heard this audio before, but the idea that there was 18 attempts to get Raffensperger on the phone, and they avoided it over and over again. Listen to this.
Why wouldn't you want to find the right answer, Brad, instead of keep saying that the numbers are right? So look, can you get together tomorrow? And Brad, we just want the truth. It's simple. And
now pause it for 1 second, okay? What's important about this is that when we first heard this, it just sounded like, you know, typical Trump, you know, just delusion. But there's so much pushback that Trump is getting from these various Republicans in Arizona, in Georgia, one or two other states, that he knows this is fake. He knows he's lying. He knows he's embarking on a project to get these people in it, and it extends to Ron Johnson. It extends to people in the House. This is a concerted effort to overturn an election. This is not Donald Trump delusion. This is Donald Trump. I got a plan. And so when you start to hear this audio with the other context, you start to realize just how nefarious this was. And of course, it was extremely close to happening.
What did he ask for Comey? Like something smart loyalty?
Yeah, I want honesty, but loyal honesty.
Honest loyalty.
Yes. And in this instance, it is quite clear what they're trying to do. There's a concerted effort here. And so when he's saying, like, I don't want to hear that the vote tally is okay. Why would you tell me that when I want to hear votes? This is mob boss stuff here. It really is. This is just criminal enterprise, period, end of story. And that means that the Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate who went along with this also knew. They were involved in a criminal conspiracy. Play the audio.
Instead of keep saying that the numbers are right. So look, can you get together tomorrow? And Brad, we just want the truth. It's simple. And everyone's going to look very good if the truth comes out. It's okay. It takes a little while, but let the truth come out. The real truth is I won by 400,000 votes, at least. So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
There you go. Give me a break, guys. I need a break. I never got a break. So I think this is going to gain a little bit more momentum. I don't know what implications it'll have in the short term. But the Democrats are doing this, you know, fairly well relative to the way Democrats generally do things. They, of course, you know, entered into it with the classic Democratic, like, underconfidence. We're not going to push too hard. We'll do one primetime, but we can't do more.
It's been more impactful than I would have expected based on the way the Democrats were selling it.
Of course. Word from our sponsor, and then we'll get to Jads Brizak. You know what the fastest growing crime in America is, ladies and gentlemen, aside from election stealing by Republicans? This crime has been around for longer than that, frankly, but it's been surging and affecting millions of Americans. I'm talking about identity theft. It happens to 1 in 20 Americans. Despite this, people have had their identity stolen, are shocked when it happens. Of course you are. You try and log into your email account one day, you see the password has changed just hours ago. Then you start getting notifications of activity from your bank, from your credit cards, from your crypto accounts. That's when you get feelings of panic. You get feelings of fear, anxiety. You get paranoid, shock, anger. And then you start feeling guilty, like I should have done something about it. I should have gone to aura.com/majority. Well, that's why I am excited that they are sponsoring this program. Aura is identity theft protection. It is fraud monitoring. It's a VPN. It's a password management system and antivirus software all combined into one easy-to-use app. This gives you multiple layers of protection. Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, monitors it for your passwords and your social security numbers, and sends alerts fast right to your phone and your email. In fact, when you sign up and you put your email address in there, it'll tell you where your password and your email combination have been compromised. When it comes to fraud, every second matters. You connect your credit card and bank accounts, you get notified of any changes up to 4 times faster than Aura's competitors. Their VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. And their antivirus software will block malware and viruses before they infect your devices. You're protected basically 360. You can protect you and your family from America's fastest growing crime. Try Aura free for 2 weeks and see if any of you or your family's personal information has been compromised. Start your free trial today at aura.com/majority. Also, don't forget, folks, you can support this program. Get the free half free of commercials by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And also, starting tomorrow, is it tomorrow? We got a special with Just Coffee. So hold your horses and get ready for tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. All right. I want to welcome to the program Jazz. Oh, we got to take a quick break. We got to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Jazz Brizak. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Jazz Brizak. She is a union organizer with Starbucks Workers United. Jazz, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jazz, we were just talking before we got on air. I asked you where you were from, and you told me Texas and Mississippi. And so I was like, how did you end up in Buffalo? Not the least of which, like, you know, it's a little colder up there. It's a little snowier. And you know, Buffalo is not the first place you think of like where you want to go, I guess. But what was it that drew you to Buffalo? And this is a couple of years ago, like three or four years ago, right?
I think my first time in Buffalo was about 3.5 years ago. I'm a big labor history nerd. I got to college in Mississippi and wanted to work with unions, and I got lucky enough to work on the United Auto Workers campaign at Nissan. And the organizer on that was Richard Bensinger. And after that, he was like, would you ever work on another union campaign again? Because, you know, campaign life is a little wild. And I was like, any campaign you want me on, I'm there. So he was working with a union in upstate New York. And I started, traveling to help with other campaigns and ended up being part of the Spot Coffee campaign up here, which was really the reason that Starbucks ended up starting out here.
I see. All right. So, and let's back up a little bit in between your work in that Nissan campaign. I want to ask you a little bit about that too. What lessons you learned there? Because I remember with that one was very disappointing in many respects. But you went on to become a Rhodes Scholar as well, right? In between, right?
Yes.
It's really an amazing story, but let's focus on what happened at that Nissan plant, and then I want to work up into Starbucks. Remind everybody what the situation was there with Nissan, and I mean, because like there was politicians who got involved in this. I mean, this became a very high profile fight.
Exactly. There's a lot of overlap actually between Nissan and Starbucks in some ways. At least in the beginning, a very different geographic area, a very different size factory versus a tiny store. But there's a lot of overlap. Nissan, also said that they were a progressive company, also gave a lot of money to every kind of organization that they could find to donate to try to, whitewash their reputation. And their union busting law firm was Littler Mendelsohn. So they would have captive audience meetings that would leave workers absolutely terrified. They would threaten, that if workers unionized, the plant was going to move to Mexico. They would try to scare people that, if they unionized, terrible things would happen. And that sounds very similar to what's been going on at Starbucks. I think what I really learned during the Nissan campaign was that companies have to pay a consequence if they treat workers the way that they do during these anti-union campaigns. And Nissan hasn't been made to pay the kind of consequence that would hold them accountable. But I'm hoping that Starbucks shows, what it actually takes to win the right to organize from a company so determined to deny it.
Now the Nissan fight happened, was it in 2015? When was this?
So it was a long campaign, but the vote was in August of 2017.
2017. Okay. And we had, I think, if I remember, and I can't remember now who the senator was at the time, but they weighed in on this, which is a pretty, you don't hear senators usually weigh in on a vote like that. At least, now I think, Sanders and maybe even Warren are fairly actively getting involved in labor fights, and to be fair, I think even Pelosi visited the nurses up in Worcester, if I remember correctly. But this was a very high profile national fight, and so you end up going to Buffalo because you want to continue to union organize. You're working for the union, and wow. So what did you do at that point? You decided like, I'm going to go work at Starbucks because this is going to be a place like this is Starbucks is ripe for organizing.
I didn't know, that it was going to be ripe for organizing. And I think in a lot of ways, it took immense dedication to overcome all of the obstacles that Starbucks threw at us. So I'm not sure it was ever exactly right, but certainly it took off. But when I moved back to Buffalo during the pandemic after graduating from school. I have always been a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and one of their slogans was get on the job and organize. And, I said, I don't want to just organize from outside. I've worked in this industry before at Panera's, and I'd been organizing Spot from the outside. And I had a friend who had been fired from Starbucks after they tried to start talking about unionizing. They were fired for cursing on the floor ostensibly so that Starbucks couldn't say that it was for union organizing. And that sounds pretty familiar given how Starbucks has been firing workers for literally having a sunburn or, you know, for showing up to work early or in a lot of the other things that they've been doing now. But anyway,
Starbucks has been firing people for showing up to work early?
Yes, they fired a committee member and union leader in Rochester for showing up early and going into the store to try to plan out what he was going to do because three workers had called off from their morning shifts.
Interesting. Okay. So continue. Sorry.
No. So, you know, I said that, you know, I wanted to work in the same industry that I was organizing. I didn't know if Starbucks was going to be, you know, a place where people would want to organize. And I didn't think that, you know, I was coming in and that would automatically mean that we were going to be able to organize, but it ended up working out pretty well.
It certainly did. I mean, and so just to be clear, so you were interested in the sort of the retail space, and particularly the coffee one, but this is sort of like an extension of the fast food organizing that people have been trying to do. And you weren't sure that it was going to happen at Starbucks. It could be at Panera or wherever it is. But the idea was to get an idea of what, like the workplace dynamics, or was it like the way that the relationship between the individual Starbucks and corporate, or what was it about? What did you expect to learn about the industry when you took that job?
So, I mean, I think, you know, I'd worked at Panera's before, and that had shown me a lot about you know, the need for a union in this industry and the powerlessness of, you know, an individual worker trying to stand up to a boss versus a collective. But I also wanted to understand, you know, what it was like to try to organize a non-union workplace and the dynamics and the anti-union campaign. And boy, did I end up seeing an anti-union campaign. But I mean, this was always part of a plan to organize, you know, industrially and not just like one company or one shop. So once we'd organized Spot, it was really, you know, how do we try to raise conditions for all baristas and all restaurant workers in a city? And then obviously it became a national campaign as more and more Starbucks workers wanted to join.
And we should say this is Buffalo is the first, your Starbucks was the first of now 150 around the country. And this has taken place in 5 months. Well, I guess 7 months, 6 months. That's pretty amazing. What are the challenges that are unique to a Starbucks versus, let's say, like the Nissan plant? And then I want to like, because it's hyper localized in some way, but you're also going against a massive company. I mean, does that help or hurt in terms of your ability? Like, can you guys be much more agile? Like, it's, you're only talking like how many people work at that Starbucks?
About 25 on average. We fluctuate sometimes depending, especially on, you know, whether Starbucks is trying to short staff us or trying to hire new people to, you know, vote in our union election, which also happened. I honestly think it's, you know, a similar fight in a lot of ways. I think the advantage we have is that, you know, most people have gone to a Starbucks or see Starbucks baristas in their day-to-day lives. So I think there's a lot of public support from how familiar this company and our role in people's lives really is. But I think in terms of how we get a first contract and how we hold this company accountable, it's very similar. You know, we need to make it socially unacceptable to be a union buster. And in the beginning of the campaign, you know, our organizing committee, including Lexi, who really started this campaign, because during Spot, she had reached out to Richard about doing the same thing at Starbucks that workers were doing at Spot. And her line then and continues to be, you know, that she loves Starbucks and we're doing this because you fight for what we love. And I think, you know, Starbucks has shown no good faith in how they've responded to that message and, you know, hasn't shown any desire to collaborate with us. Howard Schultz recently said, you know, that he had no interest in collaborating with the union. But I think, you know, they're looking for a new CEO, and there really is an opportunity here for them to, you know, put union busting behind them and put this 4,000-page filing with the labor board of all of their unfair labor practices behind them and try to actually work with us. But we'll see.
Well, hope springs eternal. Let me ask you this. What is your sense? Why do you think it's been, I mean, I don't want to say easier because I don't, you know, the effort that goes into this is enormous. But why do you think there's been more success in so far, with Starbucks than, let's say, Amazon? Do you have any insight into that from you know, your perspective? Obviously, you know a lot more about what's going on with the Starbucks stuff than Amazon. But is there structural things that exist in these workplaces that make it easier or harder?
I mean, I don't know enough about Amazon to, you know, be able to make those comparisons. I will say I think Starbucks hires people who really care about social justice, about, you know, environmental justice, Black Lives Matter and racial justice, LGBTQ rights, and then is suddenly shocked when all of these, you know, young activists that they hired suddenly want power and a union and labor rights. And I think, you know, our campaign is really trying to show you can't be progressive on all of these other issues, but anti-union, it just doesn't work that way. So I think, you know, definitely the union busting that Starbucks has thrown at us has scared a lot of people and prevented a lot of stores from organizing. But I think people are so plugged into the campaign and tuned into social media that when Starbucks is doing something in one store, we find out about it at all the other stores, and that kind of, you know, educates people about what's about to come. So when Starbucks tries to do the same anti-union meeting for the 50th time in the 50th store, the 300th time in the 300th store, it doesn't have the same impact anymore.
So it sounds like A, Starbucks is a particularly fertile ground because of the nature, I guess, that people go and work at Starbucks, and B, the more experience people have in what they're going to face, it becomes less, scary and intimidating. I mean, literally less intimidating. I mean, that's what the agenda is, right? To go in and intimidate the workers there and tell them that this isn't going to work out for you. So this is going to go on. Like, is there a – I mean, I imagine there's, what, 10,000 Starbucks and – you want votes at 10,000 of these Starbucks. Let me ask you this. There was I read the piece in the Times about you, and it was set up in like a, you know, why a Rhodes Scholar would be involved in this, essentially. And the writer, to his credit, sort of cops to the idea that when he grew up and I grew up in the 70s and 80s in particular, there was no champions of unions that were national figures. Like, where did you and he writes that, you know, the Rhodes Scholars he spoke to, your age, your cohort, far more amenable to unions and far more politically sort of engaged. Well, is this, from your perspective, a generational fight, A? And B, like, how much impact does having a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or having politicians go in and actually, you know, even when Biden mentioned Amazon or Bessemer, I mean, how much of an impact does that have when you're growing up? Because it's hard for me, with having had the absence of that, to assess.
So, I mean, I definitely think that there is a shift towards, you know, understanding intersectionality and understanding labor rights as part of that. I mean, my best friend is a Rhodes Scholar, Shruti Iyer, working on the same exact issues in India. And I definitely think that, you know, she and I, at least in conversations with Noam and other folks of that Rhodes generation, like, wouldn't have been welcome in the same way. My organizing mentor, Richard Bensinger, is 71. And, you know, he always says that we're part of Generation Union because it's not a strict, like, generation thing, but it's a group of people who believe that union rights matter. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know that Starbucks Workers United would have been the campaign it was without the coverage of the RWDSU campaign of Amazon. So I definitely think that having the public awareness of unions and, you know, I think politicians are most helpful to us when they're condemning union busting and really trying to, you know, force companies to stop their war against workers. But I think all of the public awareness of unions only helps.
Interesting. I mean, and how much has having a National Labor Relations Board that is going to take those lists of Starbucks unfair labor practices and actually take it seriously? I think they've already, you know, cited at least a half dozen, I think, Starbucks stores for that, right?
There's been a lot of complaints being issued, and, you know, the NLRB is now starting to take Starbucks to court. I will say, you know, and I understand that they're underfunded, but it's been 9 months since Rossanne Williams, then the president of Starbucks North America, led her Buffalo SWAT team, as they called it internally, into town to start busting the union. And, you know, months since people in Memphis and Buffalo were fired, and across the country, obviously. But those are the ones that are starting to be prosecuted. And, I mean, I think it's still not moving fast enough to really hold Starbucks accountable, but I am very encouraged that, you know, they're now seeking a national remedy where if Starbucks continues to bust the union anywhere across the country, they would be immediately in contempt of court. And I think that would really, you know, change the game moving forward.
So what should we look for next? Well, let me ask you this, because I assume what it is going to be more organizing at Starbucks. What can Starbucks customers do? I come in and I get my, I won't use, with all due respect, their different sizes, my large coffee. I still have, I'm a holdout. I get my large coffee. Is there something I can do or even just say to the employees there that is helpful?
I mean, just saying that you support us and, you know, ordering your Union Yes drink or, you know, wearing a pin when you come in to show your support is incredibly helpful because, you know, we get a lot of support in the beginning and right after we file and win, and then it starts tapering off and the union busting doesn't taper off. So having that ongoing support is amazing. And if you go to our social media, it's all at SB Workers United. There's a new pledge that supporters can take. It's called No Contract, No Coffee. And we're not asking anybody to boycott, but we are asking that people sign up so that, you know, as we're trying to put more pressure on Starbucks down the road, we can keep people in the loop and have, you know, a database of where our supporters are.
All right. Lastly, do you have any guidance for people who want to organize and who want to basically do what you did? Like, I'm interested in organizing. I have familiarity maybe with this sector or that sector. I've worked at these type of stores. I mean, what advice would you give someone who wants to join a workplace with the agenda of organizing folks?
First, I would say, you know, don't be too short of yourself, because just because you go into a workplace doesn't mean that, you know, you're automatically going to organize it. It's going to be people like Lexi, a 7-year partner, and Michelle, a 12-year partner who are going to really have to carry the organizing effort. And I think that's true of any workplace. Second, you know, finding a union, like Gary Bonadonna Jr.'s leadership in Workers United Upstate New York, where, you know, he was willing to take on a company this big, is amazingly helpful. But also, you know, it can be done. We said in the beginning of this campaign, we only had to win one Starbucks to prove that, you know, we could have the right to organize and we could change what it means to work at Starbucks and to be a barista. And I think that was true. And now we've, you know, won quite a bit more than the first one. But, you know, I think a tiny step can really change a lot of things about worker power.
150 times more unionization per every 6 months. I can't do the math, but we're not many years out from 10,000. Jazz Brzezak, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and set up our shots. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Michael Bronski, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Harvard University, about the grooming and the Christian politics of innocence. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Michael Bronski, professor of women's gender sexuality studies at Harvard University, who has written a piece in the Boston Review titled Grooming and the Christian Politics of Innocence. Professor Bronski, thanks so much for joining us. Obviously, there's a quality to this. In fact, you pointed out specifically of sort of just looping back around. It's been a pretty big loop. But let's start. You argue that this, the structure of these attacks have been around for about 100 years, maybe a little bit less. And let's start with that, like pre Anita Bryant, which sure. was late 60s, and we'll get to that. And it's also important to note she was very much associated with Florida. But pre-Anita Bryant, I guess we're going into the 40s now. Where did we see this sort of, I guess, rhetorical structure?
Sure. Well, I think, right, I think that we begin to see this notion of holding up children as a placeholder, right, as a placeholder for innocence, that are under threat from any number of social forces, particularly homosexuality or LGBT people. I mean, we really begin to see it maybe in the, even in the 20s or 30s with sexual psychopath laws. This certainly picks up in the post-war years in the 40s and the 50s with the attacks on gay people from the federal government, from the states, right? And of course, after the war, children become this prized commodity of America, right?
But where does this innocence, I mean, where does it, is it come from? I mean, like, what is the, because it's, you know, some kids are innocent, some kids are not. And like, what is it, what kind of work is this, is the concept of child innocence, doing for Christian conservatives or, you know, I guess fundamentalists?
Well, fundamentalists, I think, primarily, right? I mean, I think within Christianity, right, everybody who's born is born with original sin. So, actually, no one's innocent. But children, as they move towards puberty and move towards adulthood, become less and less innocent. So I think what's happening, right, is that, and I think the larger context for this is that despite the Supreme Court ruling the other day giving religious schools, you know, money from the state, you know, that in fact, you know, the religious right is, for all of its power, is actually dwindling. So they're in a very defensive position. And I think that what's happening is, right, is that it's always easy to say we're actually protecting the children. I mean, in my article, right, this is something I say actually that the Catholic Church did during the Middle Ages, blaming Jews for actually attacking and murdering children, right? It was done...
The blood libel, right.
Yeah, the blood libel. It actually was done in Japan when the Jesuits first went there to, like, convert the Japanese. The Japanese accused them of being child molesters, right? So this is not a new notion. But I think that the Christian right, and, you know, it's first articulated the way their people are articulating it now and you're correct, with Anita Bryant in 1978, when she starts a campaign called Save the Children.
And we should just say, Anita Bryant was, I guess, an activist. I mean, how would you categorize who she was within the sort of, I guess, the body politic?
Sure. I think she was an activist. I mean, she certainly got her start as an entertainer, as a singer. She was a runner-up in a Miss America contest, I believe second or third runner-up, right? She was a devout evangelical fundamentalist Christian. I mean, I know those two things were separate, but she was both, I believe. She really began to spearhead this notion of homosexuals taking over classrooms, right? Because Dade County, Florida, actually passed an anti-discrimination act that protected gay and lesbian teachers. But she quickly became
This was a big deal in 1977 huge to deal. Pass an anti-discrimination law. This was not. This is very uncommon.
It was probably the third one in the country.
And I mean, I remember Anita Bryant. I mean, I was a kid, but I remember I didn't know who she was. I just knew she was like, it was all about oranges. I can't remember exactly what it was. Like they were selling
she was
orange
the
juice
for the orange for the citrus industry in Florida.
And so she was that person, and then she used that platform,
right?
And because people have to remember, like, you know, there's only three channels at the time, and so someone who's regularly on commercials, it was pretty rare to have, like, you know, there was a handful of spokespeople. I mean, she was famous as an orange salesman, essentially, yes. I guess, or saleswoman. Yeah, and then she started to wade into this fight.
Right. And I think what's important, right, is that she was quickly joined, or she joined, or they usurped her into what we now call the religious right. Right. So she began on her own, or with tenuous ties to people like Jerry Falwell, to Pat Robertson, who is still with us, doddering as he is on the TV, right, and some other evangelicals. And she really mobilized, or they used her to really mobilize national attention.
Here's a picture of her. We're just going to throw up on the screen. And that, I mean, that is, that, you know.
She's very mom.
It was total mom, and then all of a sudden you started hearing that she was doing bad, like mean things, and and it tainted orange juice for me for years. But she successfully, essentially, got Florida to reverse the anti-discrimination law that passed in Miami-Dade County.
She did, yes, and even worse, I guess, she actually was the impetus for an initiative called Prop 106, I think, yeah, or the Briggs Initiative, which failed eventually after a year of lobbying, but which would have banned all gay and lesbian teachers from the state of California.
And that's, I mean, it's interesting to me that they tried to do that in California, of all places.
California.
As opposed to like other, I guess, southern states, but maybe on some level, like, you know, people have to understand in the 70s, there were obviously gay people everywhere, but they did not identify as gay. And so in Alabama, they may have been inclined to say no gay teachers, but if you had asked anybody in Alabama, do you have any gay teachers? They all would have been like, no.
No,
I've never met a gay person. I think a lot of people in Alabama would have said.
Right. And also, not only was it the Briggs Initiative, but there at that point by 79, maybe 1980, there were seven other states that had, or counties or districts that had passed anti-discrimination laws. And about half of them were overturned.
So there is
on the impetus coming out of Florida.
And then by 1995, you had 16 states, you write, that have a law that was colloquially referred to as no promo homo laws.
Right.
Tell us about those.
Sure. And those laws, they began in the Midwest, I believe. Colorado was the first one. And they essentially said that you could not mention homosexuality in the classroom in any way, shape, or form, right? Interestingly, at the same time in London, in the UK, there was a law passed called Section 28 that said the same thing.
And so this is and a lot of this was sort of the backlash to AIDS, essentially.
To AIDS, right. So I think we have to see Anita Bryant as backlash to the beginnings of these of from Stonewall of the gay liberation and gay rights movement. The laws in the 90s are a backlash about AIDS.
How much of this is and then we'll move up to now, but how much of this like child innocence thing is you know, and I've read a couple of pieces that theorize that part of this is also And obviously the anti-gay sentiment is also and you know everything that is sort of tangential to that is a reaction to a perceived threat to the patriarchy, to the role of man and woman in the family, and that some of this grooming stuff was also a function of women's liberation.
Completely.
Meaning that they could go into the workforce, meaning that they send their kids to child to daycare between ages 2 and 5. And we saw in the 80s around that same time where we see this backlash to the anti-gay sentiment sort of coming out of the AIDS crisis. We also see a lot of these sort of like stories about daycare centers being full of Satanists and attacking children. How much of that sort of dovetails in there? Like it feels like the innocence of children is also the vulnerability of children sort of feed each other and sort of serve a dual purpose, but ultimately says women should not be in the workplace and men should be men.
Completely, yes. And I think that when we're looking at gay rights movement or we're looking at gay liberation, which I think are two separate things, right? The gay liberation movement is more radically changing society. Gay rights is reformist. right? But they both, the resistance to them are both resistances to forms of feminism, right? So when we're looking at the daycare panic, satanic ritual plethora, and really goes on for nearly a decade, right? And all the famous cases, the McMartin in California, Fells Acres in Massachusetts, have all been discounted completely, right? But they are clearly a reaction to women being in the workplace, to women having more freedom, right? And I think, I mean, what you were gesturing to before, I think, is really at the core of it, right? It really is I want to say paranoid, but it's not completely paranoid because it's based in some sort of reality, right? That if you take the evangelical Christian notion that the man is in charge of the household and the man is the head of his wife and children and of the family, feminism erodes that, gay and lesbian liberation erodes that, transgender identity erodes that, non-binary identity erodes that. So it really is a sort of complete panic response to all of this, right? I mean, I think part of the Don't Say Gay laws, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but it's really based on a complete panic response that if you don't say gay, then gay doesn't exist, right? So it really is an attempt to sort of obliterate the very mention of gay.
And to make sure that it's not normalized, that they want to eradicate its existence, essentially.
Completely, yes. I mean, on the other hand, right, it's too late. I mean, we've actually had 50 years since Stonewall. We have to have drag queens on the TV. We have drag queen story hours. We have, I was looking at the TV the other night. I think I saw 8 same-sex couples on different commercials within 45 minutes.
Well, I mean... Let me just push back on that notion to a certain extent. I mean, I don't think we're going back to 1955, but the apparatus, I think we are very, very close to we have laws now, and the Supreme Court just recently, within as far as recently goes, found that discrimination in the workplace based upon sexuality was illegal. Unclear in terms of housing, unclear as to like how broad what fits into that category. But this court is going to be the court makeup that we're looking at now is going to be around for 30, 40 years. It's not inconceivable that they may revisit this case in the same way that they're going to revisit Roe v. Wade in the next week. Right. And so we should be clear that culturally people have moved on, but the there is still that white knuckle grip that that these fundamentalists are still sort of like now have on the apparatus in terms of like statutory type of situations.
Completely, yes. And I think one mistake people on the left and on the right often make is that they fail to realize that culture and politics run on very different tracks. Right? I mean, a clear example that's not LGBT, right, but that during the height of Jim Crow laws in the 1950s, a large part of American population loved black music.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean, but does that necessarily mean that culture is, I mean, I've heard many people articulate, even, Breitbart before he died, his favorite saying was that politics are downstream from culture. But sometimes culture and politics, it's not necessarily working that way. Right. I mean, or maybe it is downstream, but that doesn't mean that the waters, it could be downstream, but the water could be flowing in the wrong direction for a period of time.
It does. And it also doesn't mean that the politics are not deadly serious and people get hurt.
Let's talk about this resurgence. There has been an attempt, it seems to me, to sort of sidestep the issue of gay people, although in the context of Florida, we can see But I think that the backlash to that, I think, was why there was almost a strategic retreat by the conservatives. I mean, and this has become like a totem, like a signifier, in the same way that guns and at one time even the, I feel like, deficit reduction was at one point.
Sure.
To transphobia, and not just in terms of like transgender people. There's a conflation now with like transvestites and transgender people, and cross dressing, because of the political, like, have they found their sort of like Alamo on some level with this, or what, like, where does it go strategically for them?
Right. Well, I think what was so startling to me about the Don't Say Gay laws in Florida, right, because in the past 5 years, the right, there were some people complaining about homosexuals doing this or doing that, or, you know, when the Supreme Court essentially okayed same-sex marriage, that debate seemed to have ended. And all of the attacks began to go towards transgender people, right? And which made perfect sense, because transgender people were, although part of an LGBT community, were clearly, in the minds of most Americans, the more extreme manifestation of some form of sexual or gender deviance, using the word deviance in quotes.
And also just more marginally in terms of like political power and in terms of presence in society.
Probably the most vulnerable part of the LGBT community. Right. So what actually surprised me about DeSantis and about Don't Say Gay laws was that he actually backtracked a bit and actually began to attack gay and lesbian and bisexual people as well. And, you know, I mean, and amazingly attacking the, you know, one of the first times that I can think of that actually Republican began to attack business interests in his own state by attacking Disney.
Is that because there is still, I mean, people forget this about Florida, at least people who are outside of Florida, that there's Florida and then there's Florida. And, you know, the Florida that you visit for the most part, you know, or at least, you know, that we're used to in the Northeast, going down to Southern Florida and the East Coast, or, you know, the coastal Florida. But there's also, I mean, there's a long tradition, you know, we talked about Anita Bryant in that state of gay bigotry. And there's no reason really why it would be, you know, I mean, time helps a little bit, but it's a far more ripe area, I think, than people presume.
I think that's true. And that's clearly population shifts. I mean, right. In fact, the law that Anita Bryant was against was in Dade County, right, in Miami, right, because that was actually liberal, whereas the rest of the state, or most of the rest of the state, was actually conservative. So she actually had a basis in the state to actually attack the liberals that were in Miami. I mean, clearly with Rick DeSantis, we're seeing somebody who's actually platforming himself for a presidential run and using, you know, using the basis in both sense of the word, right? Issues that he thinks can, you know, whether it be vaccines or whether it can be anti-gay and lesbian rhetoric, to consolidate a sort of base against Trump.
In the course of your work, have you come across like a mechanism for, you know, pushing back on this, like, that has been successful, or is it just really just a question of time and sort of a generational struggle? Obviously, you know, like my daughter, for instance, the idea of her having a classmate with, you know, two moms or two dads, right, or frankly, classmates who are non-binary or who identify as a different gender than, you know, who are not cis. That stuff is like, I don't know. I feel like when I was in school, if somebody came from, you know, from Michigan and moved to they would be more foreign, you know, than my daughter. Like, it even doesn't even register. It's just completely normal. The idea that somebody would have an issue with it is bizarre to her. Is that basically what we've got to wait for?
I think so. I mean, I think two things are going on here, right? You began your question with what sort of political action can you take, right? And I think that after Stonewall, right, we actually saw the political action. If there was a mandate for the gay liberation movement, it was to come out, which right. has, in 50 years has been hugely successful, except in Hollywood. But usually, you know, if you watch the Tonys this year, everybody was black and queer.
Right.
Which, given it was Broadway, you know, not surprising, but amazing to see it.
Yeah, and that's something I feel like that has happened in the past 25 years. I mean, people don't understand, I think, you know, younger generation, how dramatic that and dramatically successful that has been. And I guess it makes sense on some level that it wouldn't be a trickle. Once you would hit a critical mass, there was like a cultural protection that was right. afforded to you on some level.
And there was an avalanche or a deluge of people coming out, right?
But that deluge has happened. Like, you know, and if anything, we're getting laws now where people are going back into the closet. I would imagine there are many places in this country where it is harder today to express yourself as an LGBTQ person than it was, let's say, 5 years ago.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that the other part of your question, which we have to factor into the first part as well, right, is that it does take generational change, right? I mean, if we look at suffrage, women and some men began to lobby for suffrage in 1845, and we don't get it till 1920. So literally three whole generations of people have to die before women can get the vote, right? If we're looking at Don't Say Gay laws, don't forget that next year will be the 100th anniversary of the Scopes trial.
Right.
Which is the monkey trial. And we still have schools not teaching evolution without teaching creationism. Right. So that I think that there will be generational change. I think we have to look at that change in the context of the activism that has to happen.
Right. And we should say, too, that when we talk about generational change, people are around longer, frankly. And so, you know, what used to take two or three generations now, 60, it may take a little longer in some instances.
It may take longer, right? Because in the 40s, I believe the average age of Americans was 65, and now it's in the high 70s.
There's some truth to that. It depends on what cohort you are in terms of income.
But, I'm doing an aggregate number, yes.
Right, and let's be clear, too. The a lot of those people who are out there, at least from a rhetorical standpoint, have the kind of jobs that allow them to stick around longer, sadly.
Yeah. I think the other thing we have to factor in, right, is that back in the 70s, we said gay people are everywhere, and now we have to admit that they're actually in Trump campaigns and they're actually working for Trump and they're actually, you know, the commonly used phrase within the community is that they're homo cons.
Well, it's an interesting development to see the Texas kick out essentially the log cabin Republicans.
Yes.
And so we'll see where that goes. Well, Michael Bronski, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Harvard University, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Nice being here.
All right, folks. We are still having some problems with the IMs, if I am not mistaken. We are working on it. And so we will take phone calls. I don't know if our phone calls are going to work either.
Well, they should. That was fine.
Yeah, calls worked yesterday.
Calls did work yesterday? Okay. So hopefully calls. Well, there you go with that. Yeah. So calls are working. So we will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. We'll put on the take off the voicemail in just a moment. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We rely on our members, ladies and gentlemen, for a vast amount of our revenue. YouTube ebbs and flows, We've talked about the advertising changes that happened on the podcast side that really had nothing to do with us. Podcasts have now gone to a dynamic advertising thing. I don't want advertisements like that on the show because I want to – I mean, I don't think this makes me a control freak.
Is that the thing where they put ads in sort of
– So we would just do like a break every day at 15 minutes or whatever it is, put in like a beep, and they would insert the ads. And what happened with, you know, we have a big ad broker that we've been selling ads with for years. They went to dynamic advertising. I told them I wasn't interested in it. They said, okay, we'll just continue to sell as we did. But they never told any of their salespeople that. So we only had advertisers who had been with us for years, and it took us about 6 to 8 months to realize what was going on. And so we're still playing catch up. But I'm not going to go to dynamic advertising because I don't want.
It's weird. It takes you out of it. It's more jarring than typical advertisements.
I don't like it from a show perspective, like as an experiential thing. But B, I don't want to have to like look back on every show every 2 weeks and see what they're inserting in there because they're selling, you know, whatever it is, E-Trade or I have no problem with E-Trade per se, like but I don't want financials or Raytheon or frankly, like, you know, become an Uber driver or here's crypto shit, you know, like I just don't want that. This way, the process that we have now, every product that we advertise, there may be one or two, I can't think of them, but it's conceivable there's one or two that I don't use. But every product that we advertise, I either use and like, or B, when I do this with all of them, I check out, you know, Better Business Bureau. I Google online. I don't spend weeks doing it, but I spend a little bit of time. And we also make sure that they're not, we do have like Just Coffee and Sunset Lake. I consider them movement partners. Like the stuff that they do is more than consistent with our values. And then there are like another sort of tier of advertisers, like they're not offensive. Like they're not, we had an advertiser who had a factory in the West Bank and I liked the product and they had been very, you know, they had been very good to us in terms of sponsorship, but I just said like, I can't support this. And so, you know, basically said, we can't advertise for you anymore. And there are certain industries we won't advertise for.
And there's always like a different context, though, when you see, like, for example, our show with that in mind, and then you're reading like Politico Playbook, and it's like you're getting, sure, maybe some valuable information, but up top it says sponsored by Chevron,
yeah,
or sponsored by Blackstone. I mean, you know what I mean? Just, it's just like,
yeah, it's and so what having a robust membership does is it doesn't put that kind of pressure on the show to be like, oh, they want to buy whatever it is, $5,000 worth of ads over the course of the year. But they're also, you know, they're basically just saying like, you know, gold or crypto or whatever it is. And
gambling. There's a lot of gambling ads out there. Listen to the podcasts. Like,
that's well,
like-
we did when fan. Well, there was one company.
Can't remember which one it was.
And I can't remember what it was. And then they had a scandal. And then I was like, we shouldn't be doing this anyways.
It feels, and then you have to read the disclaimer. Like, if you're in this state and have a gambling problem, it's like, maybe problem? We shouldn't be doing
exactly.
this.
Exactly.
But I got some picks for you.
I don't have a problem with other shows doing, let's say, a gambling thing. I mean,
yeah,
you know, as long as it's not being, as long as it's not inconsistent with the show, like I can understand why a sports show would do a gamble. People gamble, and I'm not a prude about it. I mean, I'll go to Vegas, I'll bet, but it's just a question of like do I want to associate the politics and the work we do on here with this product?
And basically sell the audience that values us to those folks.
Yeah. And just, but anyways, our membership allows us to do that. Or makes it easier anyways, I should say. So join themajorityreport.com. That was one of the longest pitches I think I've ever made. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. Matt, what's in the happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, we got Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent back on. We're going to be talking about Julian Assange. We'll also be talking about more of the Uvalde stuff, the RMT strike in the UK, and some other stuff too, France, Colombia. So patreon.com/leftreckoning, and we'll be doing the post-game free on Twitch tonight, so twitch.tv/leftreckoning.
All right, folks. Oh, and if you are watching us on Twitch, you can subscribe. Subscribe on Twitch. You got your Amazon Prime thing or whatever it is. You subscribe on Twitch, we get a little piece of that. You're just wasting it now if you're not subscribed. Everybody on Twitch knows that. I want to put this to a level 5 power hype train. So
we had one yesterday.
Did you?
At a level 1.
I want 5.
Chugga, 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 chugga.
See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that way.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.